Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monaco Radio's food and drink programme. I'm your host, Chiara Rimella. Coming up, as Salone del Mobile rolls into town, we find out which latteria you should be visiting in Milan.
We wanted to deploy a kind of innovation that ensures tradition is kept. But at the same time, the latteria needed to express itself in a different way.
Also in the programme, we indulge in a new approach to caviar.
It's something that everybody should experience because it's really good fun to have a couple of different caviars to taste. You have some bellinis, some creme fraiche, and then you can just eat and enjoy.
Plus, we learn about Asia's surprising love affair with the pungent durian fruit. All that here on The Menu on Monaco Radio. Those who travel back to the same cities time and time again, be it because of trade fairs or personal inclination, often develop a series of food-related rituals when in town. For many of those who head to Milan every spring for the world's most important design fair, Salone del Mobile, that often meant a visit to la Latteria San Marco. This down-to-earth, pine-sized trattoria was long known for its unfussy approach to homestyle cooking, and over the years it attracted creatives of all stripes who fell for its eccentric atmosphere. But as this beloved outpost has recently closed up shop, where can hungry design lovers go for their lunch break in between perusing the latest chairs, sofas and tables? It's time for them to discover that La Latteria wasn't in fact the only latteria in the city. We delve into the history of these milk bars turned unassuming restaurants and recommend a few handy addresses. Many of those who will be headed to Milan soon for Salone del Mobile might be heartbroken at the news that La Latteria di San Marco, known to most simply as La Latteria, has shuttered its doors. This unassuming pint-sized trattoria in Brera had become something of a go-to for the people who frequent the northern Italian city for their creative pursuits, be it fashion, design or art. And that's even if only a handful of people could sit down at each service and that booking in advance was impossible. There was something about this place. For over 50 years, owners Maria and Arturo Maggi ran it like their home kitchen, and this inevitably attracted punters. The brusque, old-school but warm style of their hospitality did it, coupled with its seemingly incongruous interiors, which combined mock Portuguese tiles with plentiful floral prints. Then there was the food, simple and traditional, starting from its hallowed lemon and bottarga spaghetti, but with an eccentric side. Chef Arturo Maggi had a thing for cooking in silver skillets because of a personal fascination with alchemy and the properties of metal. Still, the good news is that not all is lost, and not just because rumour has it that the owners, who have decided to retire, are on the lookout for someone trustworthy to take over the business. Most importantly, not everyone who went to La Latteria realised that this wasn't, in fact, the only latteria in Milan, and that there are plenty of similarly down-to-earth establishments to be discovered hidden away across the city. The latterie, or milk shops, were actually born in Milan at the end of the 19th century as places where the bounty of the surrounding region's dairy farms could be sold to the public. Soon enough, these retailers started turning into places where people could eat a humble lunch, featuring the shop's own cheeses, of course, at very affordable prices. Their dishes were basic, their ambiance often sparse, all marble tables and walls lined with white tiles, and yet, they became popular meeting points for anybody from factory workers to penniless intellectuals. On the menu, you'd find simple home-style dishes like vegetable soup and meatballs, or large mugs of milky coffee for dipping bread in, and summery cones of whipped cream dusted with cinnamon. The latteria entered the golden era in the post-war years when Italians had little money to spare, but by the 1970s, their presence started being threatened. As is often the case for this kind of traditional enterprise, the advent of supermarkets forced many such businesses to shutter across town. And yet, some latterie managed to survive and are still alive today. You'll find most of them in the neighbourhoods just outside the city centre, hiding behind their vintage-looking signage. There's Latteria Carrara, whose meatball sandwiches are particularly popular with the students of the university opposite, or Latteria Carlon, famous for its breaded swordfish that's a staple on the menu every Friday. And then there's Latteria Cicala, the image of an old-school Italian eatery with its red checker tablecloths, or Latteria Maffucci, which ventures outside the confines of traditional Lombardy cooking, given its owners are Sardinian. At La Latteria in Via Stendhal, things are decidedly Milanese. You can try the city's traditional saffron risotto here, whilst La Vecchia Latteria is slightly unconventional in its all-vegetarian offering. It's been pioneering this cuisine since the 1970s, when plant-based eating wasn't really all that common. But going to a latteria in Milan isn't just about nostalgia. Some entrepreneurs around town have decided to rethink these institutions, opening new restaurants that pay homage to the past while also bringing things up to date. Mimmo Russo's Latteria 1952 in Porta Genova is one of them. In this exposed brick space, which opened its doors in 2022, time-honored recipes are modernized and there's room for some experiments too.
The Latteria 1952 was born, as the name suggests, in 1952, when the Latteria in Via Stendhal originally opened. We took it over in 1998 and later opened this restaurant in a new site. We wanted to deploy a kind of innovation that ensures tradition is kept. But at the same time, the Latteria needed to express itself in a different way, to make people who frequent the Latteria understand that other than presenting traditional dishes, we can also make gourmet dishes. The same goes for cocktails. Over the years, traditional latteria never made cocktails. They just sold milk or made home-style dishes. At best, you could have aperitivo, something like Aperol or Rabarbaro liquor, or things like that.
Updating tradition doesn't necessarily mean revolutionizing recipes. It's more about finding small ways of making improvements to cooking techniques and playing around with all aspects of a meal, from food to drink.
For us, tradition shouldn't be messed with. For example, our risotto alla milanese is made exactly as it was born. Innovation and tradition marry at the latteria when we pair the dishes we have created with traditional dishes and the world of mixology. So you could come to us and eat a risotto while drinking a gin tonic.
But perhaps the most relevant way in which the new latteria can stay true to tradition is in respecting the spirit and role these institutions played in Milan's neighborhoods.
When we took over the latteria in 1998, we always tried to maintain those strong points that made the latteria popular all around Milan. The fact there were points of aggregation that sold good food. We maintained that philosophy. Community is the most important thing. Coming to the latteria doesn't mean sitting down and spending 10, 20, 50, 100 euros. There's no such thing as an average bill for us. We brought the philosophy of the old latteria into the new latteria.
So whether you choose to stick to old school or go for an updated version of the classic, there's plenty of latterie still left to explore across Milan. Milk them while you can. For Monocle in Milan, I am Chiara Rinella. When it comes to luxury ingredients, there are few that are considered as opulent as caviar. The so-called black gold is traditionally served at lavish celebrations and fine dining restaurants, but the image of this delicacy sometimes puts people off trying it. From questions around sustainability to its exclusive reputation, it can feel hard for caviar to appeal to those who aren't interested in sipping champagne and eating it off a blini. That's why Caviar House and Prunia are trying out a new approach. This internationally renowned brand, set on London's Piccadilly, is something of a city institution. Despite being rooted in tradition, the company is making small changes such as experimenting with flavour combinations and collaborating with restaurants, which have allowed it to rejuvenate its offerings and attract a fresh crowd. This programme's producer, Monica Lillis, sat down with Lucy Herring, the brand's caviar expert, to find out more about the future of the ingredient and sample some for herself.
Caviar House and Prunier is one of the oldest farmed caviar brands in the world. They're over 100 years old. And we're the very first to produce farmed caviar, which is Prunier. So that was about 1993. So they were leaders and pioneer in the field of farming, which was pretty good and quite lucky because about 10, 15 years later, CITES put a ban on all wild fishing. So traditionally, caviar is called caviar when it comes from the Caspian or the Black Seas, and it has to come from a sturgeon, of which there are many different species within the sturgeon family.
So yeah, Caviar House and Prunier were the first to do that. Prunier has a farm which is just outside of Bordeaux, about an hour and a half, have about 150,000 sturgeon to date.
Wow.
Yeah, and they grow them from fingerlings. So if you were thinking about caviar farming, normally you would get a tradition, which is kind of a berry sturgeon. They're quite young. They reach maturity at about 6 to 8 years old. So you have to look after them for all that time. And then depending how you go up with your caviar, you then have an Ossietra, which is about 12 years old. Beluga, 18 to 20 year olds before you're getting maturity.
So that's really quite old.
Yeah. It's a huge investment. And that's farmed caviar. If you were fishing in the wild, beluga is normally 25 years old. So they're all a bit older.
Caviar is very much synonymous with, you know, luxury, which can sometimes maybe feel a little bit outdated or intimidating for quite a lot of people. How does Caviar House as a brand evolve to maybe be a bit more inclusive or modern and maybe make the ingredient less scary to...
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And there's a barrier for caviar. I know from the Piccadilly flagship restaurant that we have, people are quite daunted in coming in and thinking it's just caviar and how do I eat caviar and what caviar do I pick? And if you present them with a menu, they're then lost with the different species within sturgeon and the different types. So each brand will have a slightly different variety dependent on the eggs that come out of the sturgeon and how they're curing it and salting it. So within that, there's all these other nuances. So yeah, it's a big barrier. It's something that as a brand, we are trying to overcome. We have just introduced an afternoon tea. So it's got caviar laced through every tier on the menu. And it kind of just makes it a bit more accessible to people.
Yeah.
So you do get a small tin each, like the size of this that we've got today to try with the tea. And then you can kind of play with it. So some dishes do already come with caviar within them on top. We have a really good grilled egg sandwich and there's some macarons with a bit of caviar on top, which is delightful. But we really like to get people to play with it. I think it's something that everybody should experience because it's really good fun to have a couple of different caviars to taste. You have some bellinis, some creme fraiche, and then you can just eat and enjoy as like a group gathering almost. It's more of an experience than just eating it for the sake of eating it.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of for the listener who maybe might not know, what kind of taste, I know they all sort of have different tastes, but what kind of taste does it bring to, say, a macaron? You know, you wouldn't necessarily think of caviar with something sweet. So what kind of taste does it bring there?
So that then depends on the type of caviar you're pairing with it. I generally would say if you've got quite a strong base flavour, the caviar you're going to garnish with it should be quite strong and salty to cut through. If you've got something more delicate like a pastry or we have a sorbet in the store, you need something a bit lighter that blends more with the flavour so it's not going to overpower it so you can taste all the different ingredients within it. So tradition, which is the caviar that we're going to taste today, that's almost like what I think, if you haven't eaten caviar before, you will think that's what caviar tastes like. It's quite strong, it's quite salty. It's a berry sturgeon, so it's the type of sturgeon that most people will use as a garnish because it cuts through flavours and you can really taste it. So as the fish get older, the eggs get slightly larger and they lighten in colour. So normally when you're looking at caviar to buy, that's one of the things you will look at, like the difference in the black eggs there to the slightly grey. And then beluga is more kind of pearlescent in their colour.
And is it something that you see? So you're talking a little bit about like the afternoon tea and putting it on different ingredients. I find that interesting how you kind of revert back to the classic, having it as more of like with your aperitif. And how do you see like the ingredient evolving? In that sense, do you see it like being used all through the courses or is it something that you want to like remain the classic?
I think it. Some people will just have it as the classic forever. But I think for it to evolve, it needs to pair with more ingredients. And I think chefs, certainly around London and in France, aren't afraid to experiment with different flavours and the sweet and the savoury and just mixing it in. We did a collaboration last year with a chef in London, and we had 7 courses, which was through from start to finish. Every single one had caviar, and it pairs beautifully. You then just need to know the difference with the caviar you're tasting and what you're going to pair it with. And most chefs who are worth their weight will know that and test it.
And, you know, you're talking a bit about the experience, weren't you? Like, it makes it something new and something different to try.
Yep. You do caviar tastings, so we started doing them last year.
Which is what we're going to do now.
Yeah, quite. You're having a private version.
So it's really interesting. We were kind of talking about before, it's kind of a bit of a scary ingredient, and maybe the listener doesn't know where to start. So maybe you could kind of talk us through about how we eat it.
Sure.
And the different colours, as we already spoke about.
But are you ready to try?
Should we do this? Yeah.
Right, okay.
I'm a bit nervous because this is breakfast, but
yes. So normally I would say if you were buying caviar or you've just opened a tin, to just try a small amount on the bump on your hand, say between your thumb and forefinger. There's numerous reasons for that. The main one is just to check that it doesn't smell. And then once you've eaten it off there, it's not oily. If it smells or is oily, it's probably old or just not good caviar. So that's how you would normally eat it, and that's going to give you the best taste, so you can decide which one you like. So on the back of your hand, and then when you taste it, you just want to kind of roll it around your mouth, push it against the roof of your mouth with your tongue, and just let the flavour kind of explode.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very salty.
Yes, so this is tradition. This is the Prunier tradition range. So it's from a Berry surgeon, which is quite similar to a Savruga. So it's quite salty, it's small, it's young, it's very fresh and punchy. And it's, again, the kind of caviar that I think, if you haven't had caviar, that's what you think caviar tastes like.
Yeah, definitely.
It's got just that whole punchiness and sea kind of flavour that... that I think everyone expects caviar to taste like.
Talk to us about beluga then, because I think when people think of luxury caviar, they're probably going to be thinking of beluga.
Yeah, so beluga's interesting. It's the carnivore, the only carnivore in the sturgeon family. So it tastes quite distinct. It also has a slightly darker oil, and that's because of what it eats. And it has a more intense flavour, less fishy in a way.
Okay.
It's still got the nuttiness. It's normally from an older sturgeon. So in some farms, they reach maturity or they harvest them from about 18 years. In the wild, they would normally be 25 years upwards. So that also means that the eggs will be slightly larger. So everything you buy depends on how much time and effort has gone into it. So it makes sense that beluga, because it comes from an older sturgeon, it's had that much more time and care put into it. So it will be more expensive. And it's certainly the most coveted. I think people know beluga. There is one caviar that is more expensive than that, but it's very rare. Mm. And that is called Almas. So that's like a creamy, goldeny colour, very big eggs. Anything from 60 years, I think purists would say 100.
Wow, okay.
So it's very old, very mature, creamy, buttery, like delicious, but so rare that when it does come out, it's extremely expensive. I think the current market rate is, I think, around 50,000 for a kilo.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So definitely not going to be trying that one today.
So let's try the beluga.
Yeah, definitely.
So the eggs on this, it's really good because it's under that light.
Yeah, it does look pretty.
Yeah, they're slightly clearer and more pearly.
Yeah, they definitely are.
Yeah.
It's very, like, bold flavour.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the other one's punchy, but this is more like in
the
front of
your mouth. It's longer lasting as well. Mm. You'll taste it for a long time. Like, yeah. It's lovely.
Monica Lillis there, speaking to Lucy Herring of Caviar House. This is The Menu. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's George Ruskin.
The UK government has relaxed its rules on wine packaging and producers have already begun experimenting with bottle sizes. New quantities include 200 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles, as well as the emergence of the concept of a pint of wine. Meanwhile, in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis has lifted the state's 1 gallon restriction on wine sales, paving the way for quantities of up to 15 litres in stores. This will come into effect on the 1st of July. In France, a court has suspended a decree banning plant-based products from using terms like steak on their labels. This follows backlash from the plant-based food industry when the ban was announced by the French government back in February. The court cited doubts over the legality of the ban under EU law and has opted to wait for clarification from the European Court of Justice. In South Korea, dissatisfaction with President Yoon Suk-yeol reached boiling point after his recent trip to a food market on the campaign trail. The president marvelled at the low price of spring onions amidst rising food prices in the country, where a single apple now costs as much as $7 in some stores. His comments angered voters ahead of yesterday's election defeat for his party and has led to suggestions that the president could be toppled by a spring onion. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Kiara.
Thanks, George. You're listening to The Menu. And finally, here on The Menu, the market for durian fruit is booming. This famously smelly fruit, native to Southeast Asia, remains a hit in the region, despite many finding it unbearable to sniff, to the point that it's banned on public transport in the likes of Singapore. Data from 2023 showed that sales of the fruit surged 400% year on year, driven almost entirely by demand from China. Countries around the region are jostling to supply China's insatiable hunger for the fruit. Thailand is reaping most of the rewards, having exported 2.8 billion euros of the costly foodstuff in 2022. But with Chinese demand on track to keep growing, Bangkok faces competition from its neighbours. For more on this story, Lillian Fawcett spoke to HSBC's Asian economist Aris Dekanai, who has penned reports on the Asian durian market.
Around 2015 to 2018, this trend started in China, where durian suddenly became the status symbol where you give durian to actually newly engaged couples or soon-to-be mother-in-laws. Now, of course, with China's very, very big population, basically it led to this big boom in the durian market. And just to show you some numbers or to just give some reference to the audience, the ASEAN's durian market was around 600 million in 2016, 2017. Now it's a $6.3 billion market. So in a span of 6-7 years, it multiplied by basically 10. And majority of this increase was because of this boom in China. And basically the economies that benefited from this boom were 100% from ASEAN. Now, who benefited at first? It was actually Thailand. Thailand and China does have a long history of durian diplomacy, if I may say. So back in 1975, what happened was when the Thai-Chinese diplomatic relations started, the prime minister went to China, went to Beijing. With him were 160 delegates from the Thai government and 200 pieces of durian. So it all started from there. It became a status symbol. It boomed. Thailand benefited. Now, it's not only Thailand who has a slice of the durian pie. It's actually Vietnam as well. From around 90% of market share of ASEAN's exports, it actually dropped to around 65%. The majority of at least the displacement was from Vietnam. Vietnam now has 35% of durian ASEAN export market share.
You mentioned there, obviously, different countries competing to supply China. Are you seeing any other countries in Southeast Asia kind of jump at the chance to get a slice of this huge Chinese durian market?
Everyone's trying to get a slice of this durian pie. And so far, it was only been Vietnam has been successful. So you have President Marcos, or President Marcos is the president of the Philippines, who in January of 2023 actually flew to China, flew to Beijing and met President Xi Jinping himself. And they made 14 big deals between the Philippines and China. And one of those big deals is for the Philippines to be allowed to export fresh durian to China. And because of that, the Philippines exported its first durian sometime in April 2023, and now it now has a 0.2% market share. Now, it's still pretty small, but we do expect that to grow. Other countries, such as Malaysia, are still trying to have that same deal with China. Malaysia has this variety called the Musang King. It's the most expensive variety amongst all the popular varieties. And so far, they're not allowed to export fresh Musang King to China. They have to put it in plastic, vacuum seal it, box it, and then they're able to export it to China. So they're still able to consume it, but at the same time, fresh durian is a different thing, which Thailand, Vietnam, and the Philippines, they're the only three ASEAN economies that have a privilege to export this in fresh form. But there's also a speed train, a 10,000-kilometer speed train that cuts across Laos and enters China. This is specifically the way Thailand exports its durian. So trade has just been really smooth. The trade corridor is open, and there's just a free exchange of durian. And I just want to point out as well how big of a thing this is. Durian is also at the same level as the value of rice exports. And I mean, that's no small feat given the fact that Thailand is the second top rice exporter in the world. So durian has become a prominent commodity, so prominent that it could actually affect currency, the Thai baht. You had the Thai central bank basically saying at around third quarter of last year, saying that their currency, the Thai baht, actually was well supported or at least strengthened a little bit, mainly because of demand from durian.
Are you expecting in the coming years for there to be any interest from outside Asia, or is there any interest from outside Asia now? I mean, you just don't see durian really in Europe or, as far as I know, anywhere outside Asia, whereas in Singapore and a lot of Southeast Asia, it's just kind of everywhere. You can buy it in the street. But do you see that changing in the coming years?
I do hope so. I mean, it's going to benefit Southeast Asia a lot if that tradition of giving durian to your special loved one will be basically normalized to the rest of the world. There's still a lot of marketing to do. It's hard to market a fruit as smelly as durian. So far, it's concentrated to China. Basically, growth in durian has been flat elsewhere. So hopefully, we get to export more of them.
I mean, I suppose it's an acquired taste, firstly, like you say, so it's difficult to market, but also it's probably quite difficult to transport, I would think, as well.
So there's a quirky detail here. As a Southeast Asian, what we do when we buy durian is we get the fruit, we touch it, we see whether what it feels, and based on what we feel, that's when we know when it's the freshest or not. So durian is something that you hold, you touch, before you actually buy it. But in China, people are actually buying it online. So sometime in 2018, Alibaba, it's an online retail shop, basically. And they had this special promo where there were 200 tons of durian to be sold. And in 1 minute, just 1 minute when that promo went open, 80,000 pieces of fresh durian were sold. Again, these people has never touched the durian that they were buying. It was all online. They just saw the picture and they just bought it. So I have to say that's not the practice in Southeast Asia. But then again, maybe online shopping helps because you don't get to smell it. I don't know, but it is a very fun fact to share.
Thanks, Lillian. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show, Food Neighborhoods, for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Rimella. This program was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan, Lily Austin, and Jack Jewers. Thanks for listening, and until next week.